There is, however, no reason whatever why all these materials should be used, and, if the child is wisely treated, and reasonably guided, he will be encouraged to develop to the fullest all the germs of good which he has brought over from his previous life, while the evil germs will be allowed to slumber. If that is done, these evil germs will gradually atrophy, and drop away from him, and the ego will unfold within himself the opposite virtues, and then he will be free, for all his future lives, from the evil qualities which these germs indicated. Parents and teachers may help him towards this desirable consummation, not so much by any definite facts which they teach him, as by the encouragement which they give to him, by the rational and kindly treatment uniformly accorded to him, and, above all, by the amount of affection lavished upon him. In the astral body and the mental body, in the chapters on rebirth, we have already laid great stress on the immense services which may, and should be, rendered to an ego, by those who are responsible for his upbringing and training, so that it is unnecessary to repeat here what was said in those books. We may, however, add that one who, instead of arousing love and good qualities in his charges, awakens in them evil qualities, such as fear, deceit, and the like, is hampering the progress of the egos concerned, and thus doing them serious positive harm. Misuse of such an opportunity involves a terrible fall for the man. In some cases, for example, cruelty of this nature may result in insanity, hysteria, or neurasthenia. In other cases, it results in a cataclysmic descent in the social scale, such as a Brahmin being reborn as a pariah, as a result of cruelty to children. On the same principle, a man who, having wealth and power, uses his position to oppress his employees, generates very bad karma. The only aspect of the matter, which concerns the agents of karma, is that the man in such a position has in his hands an opportunity of being a helpful influence in the life of a number of people. He neglects or abuses such an opportunity at his own peril. Page 111, Chapter 24, The Ego and Reincarnation, page 163. We come now to deal more specifically with the attitude which the ego takes up towards his incarnation in a personality. Since the appointed method for the evolution of the latent qualities of the ego is by means of impacts from without, it is clearly necessary that the ego should descend far enough to enable him to meet such impacts as can affect him. The method of achieving this result is, as we know, that of reincarnation, the ego putting forth part of himself into the lower planes for the sake of the experience to be gained there, and then withdrawing back again into himself, bearing with him the results of his endeavor. It must not be thought, however, that the ego makes any movement in space. It is rather that he endeavors to focus his consciousness at a lower level, to obtain an expression through a denser variety of matter. This putting forth of part of himself into incarnation has often been compared with an investment. The ego expects, if all goes well, to reclaim not only the whole of his capital invested, but also a considerable amount of interest, and he usually obtains this. But, as with other investments, there is occasionally loss instead of gain, for it is possible that some portion of that which he puts down may become so entangled with the lower matter that it may be impossible wholly to reclaim it. With this investment aspect of reincarnation we shall deal in full detail in our next chapter. The student will by now have fully realized that each stage of the descent of the ego into incarnation, page 164, means submission to limitation. Consequently, no expression of the ego upon any of the lower planes can ever be a perfect expression. It is merely an indication of its qualities, just as a picture is a representation, on a two-dimensional surface, of a three-dimensional scene. In exactly the same way, the true quality, as it exists in the ego, cannot be expressed in matter of any lower level. The vibrations of the lower matter are altogether too dull and sluggish to represent it. The string is not sufficiently taut to enable it to respond to the note which resounds from above. It can, however, be tuned to correspond with it in a lower octave, like a man's voice singing in unison with a boy's, expressing the same sound, as nearly as the capabilities of the inferior organism permit. It is not possible in physical language to express exactly this matter of the descent of the ego, but until we are able to raise our own consciousness to those levels, and see exactly what takes place, the best impression we can have of it is perhaps the idea of the ego putting down part of himself, like a tongue of fire, into planes of matter grosser than his own. The ego, belonging as he does to a higher plane, is a much greater and grander thing than any manifestation of him can be. His relation to his personalities is that of one dimension to another, that of a square to a line, or a cube to a square. No number of squares could ever make a cube, because the square has only two dimensions, while the cube has three. So no number of expressions on any lower, page 112, plane can ever exhaust the fullness of the ego. Even if he could take 1,000 personalities, he could still not sufficiently express all that he is. The most for which he can hope is that the personality will contain nothing which is not intended by the ego, that the personality will express as much of the ego as can be expressed in this lower world. Whilst the ego may have but one physical body, for that is the law, he can insult any number of thought forms which friends who love him may make of him, and he is only too pleased to have these additional opportunities of manifesting himself, as he is able, through those thought forms, to develop qualities in himself. Page 165, just as in physical consciousness a man may be simultaneously conscious of many physical contacts, as well as of emotions, and of thoughts, without any confusion, so may the ego be simultaneously conscious and active through both his own personality, and also through any number of thought forms which his friends may make of him. The wise man thus recognizes that the true man is the ego, not the personality, or the physical body, and he sees that it is the life of the ego only which is really of moment, and that everything connected with the body must unhesitatingly be subordinated to those higher interests. He recognizes that this earth life is given to him for purposes of progress, and that that progress is the one important thing. The real purpose of life is the unfoldment of his powers as an ego, the development of his character. He recognizes that this development is in his own hands, and that the sooner it is perfected the happier, and more useful will he be. Furthermore, he soon learns by experience that nothing can be really good for him, as an ego, or for anyone, which is not good for all. In due time he thus learns to forget himself altogether, and to ask only what will be best for humanity as a whole. The development of the ego is thus the object of the whole process of descent into matter. The ego assumes veils of matter precisely because through them he is able to receive vibrations to which he can respond, so that his latent faculties may thereby be unfolded. The whole object of the ego putting himself down is that he may become more definite, that all his vaguely beautiful feelings may crystallize into a definite resolution to act. All his incarnations form a process by means of which he may gain precision and definiteness. Page 166, hence specialization is his way of advancement. He comes down into each race or sub-race in order that he may acquire the qualities for the perfection of which that sub-race is working. The fragment of the ego which is put down is highly specialized. When a certain quality is developed, the ego absorbs it into himself in due course, and he does that over and over again. The personality scatters something of its special achievement over the whole, when it is withdrawn into the ego, so that the ego becomes a little less vague than before. Page 113, in the Gita Theosophy, pages 183-184, H.P. Blavatsky describes the objective of reincarnation in vivid language. Try to imagine a spirit, a celestial being, whether we call it by one name or another, divine in its essential nature, yet not pure enough to be one with the all, and having, in order to achieve this, so to purify its nature as finally to gain its goal. It can do so by passing individually and personally, that is, spiritually and physically, through every experience and feeling that exists in the manifold or differentiated universe. It has, therefore, after having gained such experience in the lower kingdoms, and having ascended higher and still higher with every rung of the ladder of being, to pass through every experience on the human planes. In its very essence it is thought, and is, therefore, called in its plurality, Manasaputra, the sons of, universal, mind. This individualized thought is what we theosophists call the real human ego, the thinking entity imprisoned in a case of flesh and bones. This is surely a spiritual entity, not matter, that is not matter as we know it on the plane of the objective universe, and such entities are the incarnating egos that inform the bundle of animal matter called mankind, and whose names are manasa or minds. The student should note that the term manasaputra, which means literally the sons of mind, is used in the above quotation in a special sense. The term is a wide one, and covers many grades of intelligences, from the sons of flame themselves, down to the entities who individualized the moon chain, and took their first purely human incarnation in the earth chain. Page 167, many similes and metaphors have from time to time been employed, to illustrate, the relation between the ego and his personalities, or incarnations. Thus, each incarnation has been compared to a day at school. In the morning of each new life, the ego takes up his lessons again, at the point where he left it the night before. The time taken by the pupil in qualifying himself is left entirely to his own discretion and energy. The wise pupil perceives that school life is not an end in itself, but merely a preparation for a more glorious and far wider future. He cooperates intelligently with his teachers, and sets himself to the maximum of work which is possible for him, in order that as soon as he can he may come of age and enter into his kingdom as a glorified ego. The dipping down of the ego into the physical world, for brief snatches of mortal life, has been likened to the diving of a bird into the sea after a fish. Personalities are also like the leaves put forth by a tree. They draw in material from outside, transform it into useful substance, and send it into the tree as sap, by which the tree is nourished. Then the leaves, having served for their season, wither and drop off, to be in due time succeeded by a fresh crop of leaves. As a diver may plunge into the depths of the ocean to seek a pearl, so the ego plunges into the depths of the ocean of life to seek the pearl of experience, but he does not stay there long, for it is not his own element. He rises up again, into his own atmosphere, and shakes off the heavier element, which he leaves behind. Therefore it is truly said that the soul that has escaped from earth has returned to its own place, for its home is the land of the gods and on earth it is an exile and a prisoner. The ego may be regarded as a laborer who goes out into a field, toiling in rain and sunshine, in cold and heat, returning home at night. But the laborer is also the proprietor, and all the results of his labor fill page 168, his own granaries, and enrich his own store. Each personality is the immediately effective part of the individuality, representing it in the lower world. There is no injustice in the lot that falls to the personality, because the ego sowed the karma in the past, and the ego must reap it. The laborer that, page 114, sowed the seed must harvest it, though the clothes in which he worked as sower may have worn out during the interval between the sowing and the reaping. He who reaps is the same as he who sows. And, if he sowed but little seed or seed badly chosen, it is he who will find but a poor harvest when, as reaper, he goes again into the field. The ego has been described as moving in eternity like a pendulum between the periods of life terrestrial and life posthumous. The hours of the posthumous life, to one who really understands, are the only reality. So very often, the ego really begins his personal life cycle with the entry into the heaven world, and pays a minimum of attention to the personality during its period of collecting materials. As we have seen, in the cycle of incarnation, the period spent in Devachan, which, for all except for the very primitive, is of enormous duration compared with the breaks in it spent on earth, may fairly be called the normal state. A further reason for regarding this as the normal, the earth life as the abnormal, is that in Devachan the man is much nearer the source of his divine life. The ego may be regarded as the actor, his numerous and different incarnations, being the actor's parts. Like an actor, the ego is bound to play many such parts, which often are disagreeable to him, but like a bee, collecting honey from every flower, the ego collects only nectar of mortal qualities and consciousness, from every terrestrial personality in which he has to clothe himself, until at last he unites all these qualities in one, and becomes a perfect, being, sometimes termed a Dian chicken. Page 169, in the voice of the silence the personalities are spoken of as shadows, the candidate for initiation is exhorted thus, have perseverance as one who doth evermore endure. Thy shadows live and vanish, that which in thee shall live forever, that which in thee knows, for it is knowledge, is not a fleeting life, it is the man that was, that is, and will be, for whom the hour shall never strike. Thus through the ages the ego, the immortal thinker, patiently toils at his work of leading the animal man upwards, till he is fit to become one with the divine. Out of any one life he may win but a mere fragment for his work, yet on that slightly improved model will be molded the next man, each incarnation showing some advance, though in the early stages it may be almost imperceptible. Slowly is accomplished the task of lessening the animal, of increasing the human. At a certain stage in this progress, the personalities begin to become translucent, to answer to the vibrations from the thinker, and dimly to sense that they are something more than isolated lives, are attached to something permanent and immortal. They may not quite recognize their goal, but they begin to thrill and quiver under the touch of the ego. Thereafter, progress becomes more swift, the rate of development increasing enormously in the later stages. The above are but analogies, useful perhaps, but crude, for it is a matter of exceeding difficulty to express the relation of the ego to the personality. On the whole, perhaps the best way to put it is to say that the personality is a fragment of the ego, a tiny part of him expressing itself under serious difficulties. When we meet another person on the physical plane, it would be somewhere near the truth to say that we know a thousandth part of the real man. Moreover, the part that we see is the worst part. Even if we are able to look at the causal body of another man, we see but a manifestation of the ego on his own plane, and are still far from seeing the true man. Page 115, regarding the ego as the real man, and looking at him on his own plane, we see him to be indeed a glorious being. The only way in which down here we can form a conception, page 170, of what he really is to think of him as some splendid angel. But the expression of this beautiful being on the physical plane may fall far short of all this. In fact, it must do so, first, because it is only a tiny fragment, secondly, because it is so cramped by its conditions. If a man puts his finger into a hole in the wall, or into a small metal pipe, so that he cannot even bend the finger, it is obvious that he could express but very little of himself through that finger. Much like this is the fate of that fragment of the ego which is put down into this dense body. We may carry the analogy a little further, by supposing that the finger has a considerable amount of consciousness of its own, so that, shut off as it is from the rest of the body, it temporarily forgets that it is merely a part of the whole body. Forgetting the freedom of the wider life, it tries to adapt itself to the whole, it gilds its sides and makes it an enjoyable whole by acquiring money, property, fame and so forth, not realizing that it only begins really to live when it withdraws itself from the whole altogether, and recognizes itself as a part of the body. Clumsy as is the image, it may yet give some sort of idea of the relation of the personality to the ego. Other, and more picturesque analogies are to be found in certain ancient myths. Thus Narcissus was a youth of great beauty, who fell in love with his own image reflected in the water, and was so attracted by it that he fell in and was drowned, and was afterwards changed by the gods into a flower and bound to earth. This of course refers to the ego looking down upon the waters of the astral plane and the lower world, reflecting itself in the personality, identifying itself with that personality, falling in love with its image, and being bound to earth. So also Proserpine, while picking the Narcissus, was seized and carried off by desire to the underworld, and although she was rescued from complete captivity by the efforts of her mother, yet after that she, page 171, had to spend her life half in the lower world and half in that above, that is to say, partly in material incarnation, and partly out of it. Another old mystery teaching was that of the Minotaur, which signified the lower nature in man's personality which is half man and half animal. This was eventually slain by Theseus, who typifies the higher self, or the individuality, which has been gradually growing and gathering strength, until at last it can wield the sword of its divine father. The spirit, guided through the labyrinth of illusion, which constitutes these lower planes, by the thread of occult knowledge given him by Ariadne, who represents intuition, the higher self is enabled to slay the lower, and to escape safely from the web of illusion. Yet there still remains for him the danger that, developing intellectual pride, he may neglect intuition, even as Theseus neglected Ariadne, and so fail for a time to realize his highest possibilities. It is abundantly clear that a view of reincarnation can be obtained, in proper perspective, only if we regard it from the point of view of the ego. Each movement of the ego towards the lower planes is a vast, page 116, circular sweep. The limited vision of the personality is a partment to take a small fragment of the lower arc of the circle, and regard it as a straight line, attaching quite undue importance to its beginning and ending, while the real turning point of the circle entirely escapes it. From the point of view of the ego, during the earlier part of that little fragment of existence on the physical plane, which we call life, the outward force of the ego is still strong. At the middle of it, in ordinary cases, that force becomes exhausted, and the great inward sweep begins. Nevertheless, there is no sudden or violent change, for this is not an angle, but still part of the curve of the same circle, exactly corresponding to the moment of aphelion in a planet's course round its orbit. Yet it is the real turning point of that little cycle of evolution, though with us it is not marked in any way. Page 172, in the old Indian scheme of life it was marked as the end of the grihastha or householder period of the man's earthly existence. In that ancient system, a man spent the first 21 years of his life in education, and the next 21 in doing his duty as householder and head of the family. But then, having attained middle life, he gave up altogether his worldly cares, resigned his house and property into the hands of his son, and retired with his wife into a little hut nearby, where he devoted the next 21 years to rest and spiritual converse and meditation. After that came the fourth stage, of perfect isolation and contemplation in the jungle, if he wished it. In all this, the middle of life was the real turning point. And it is evident that it is a much more important point than either physical birth or death, for it marks the limit of the outgoing energy of the ego, the change, as it were, from his out-breathing to his in-breathing. From this point, there should be nothing but a steady drawing inward of the whole force of the man, and his attention should be more and more withdrawn from mere earthly things and concentrated on those of higher planes. Such considerations cannot fail to impress upon us how exceedingly ill-adapted to real progress are the conditions of modern European life. In this arc of evolution, the point at which the man drops his physical body is not a specially important one, by no means so important, in fact, as the next change, his death on the astral plane, and his birth into the heaven world, or otherwise expressed, the transfer of his consciousness from the astral to mental matter, in the course of the steady withdrawal mentioned. As was mentioned in Chapter 13, the whole course of the movement down into matter is called in India the Pravritti Marga, literally the path of pursuit of forthgoing. The Nivritti Marga is the path of return, of retirement, of renunciation. These terms are relative, and can be applied to the whole course of the, page 173, evolution of the ego, to an individual incarnation in a personality, etc. On the Pravritti Marga, on which are the vast majority of men, desires are necessary and useful, these being the motives that prompt him to activity. On the Nivritti Marga, desire must cease. What was desire in the Pravritti Marga, becomes will on the Nivritti Marga. Similarly, thought, alert, flighty, changing, becomes reason, work, activity, restless action, becomes in its turn sacrifice, its binding force thus being broken. Page 117, Chapter 25, The Ego and His Investment, page 174, we come now to study the subject of reincarnation, regarding the putting forth by the ego of a personality as an investment made by the ego. This investment analogy is not a mere figure of speech, but has a definite and material side to it. When the ego, in his causal body, takes to himself in addition a mental and an astral body. The operation involves the actual entangling of a portion of the matter of his causal body with matter of those lower astral and mental types. This putting down of a portion of himself is, therefore, closely analogous to an investment. As in all investments, the ego hopes to get back more than he puts out. There is a risk, however, a risk of disappointment, a possibility that he may lose something of what he invests. In fact, under very exceptional circumstances, there may even be a total loss which leaves him, not absolutely bankrupt, but without available capital. Elaborating on this analogy, we may remind ourselves that the causal body consists of matter of the first, second and third subplanes of the mental plane. By far the greater portion of it belongs to the first subplane, a lesser portion belongs to the second subplane, and still less to the third. For the vast majority of men, there is as yet no activity beyond the lowest of these three types, and even that is usually partial. It is, therefore, only some of the lowest type of causal matter that can be put down to lower levels, and only a small fraction even of that part can be entangled with mental and astral matter. Hence, only a very small portion of the ego is an activity with reference to the personality. Page 175, in fact, with people who are unevolved, probably not more than 1/100th part of the matter of the third subplane is active. With occult students, a little of the second subplane matter is generally an activity also. More advanced students have a great deal of that subplane in activity, and in the stage below that of an arhat, about one half of the ego is active. The ego, being as yet half asleep, has but a very weak and imperfect control of that which he puts down. But, as his physical body grows up, and his astral and mental bodies also develop, the causal matter entangled with them is awakened by the vigorous vibrations which reach it through them. The fraction of a fraction, which is fully entangled, gives life and vigor, and a sense of individuality, to these vehicles, and they in turn react strongly upon it, and arouse it to a keen realization of life. This keen realization of life is, of course, exactly what it needs. The very object, for which it is put down. And it is the longing for this keen realization which is Krishna, with which we have already dealt in a previous chapter. Page 118, but just because this small fraction has had these experiences, and is therefore, so much more awake than the rest of the ego, it may often be so far intensified as to think itself the whole, and forget for a time its relation to its Father in heaven. It may temporarily identify itself with the matter through which it should be working, and may resist the influence of that other portion which has been put down, but not entangled, that which forms the link with the great mass of the ego on his own plane. Diagram 26 may serve to make this matter a little more clear. The causal body is here shown as roughly the shape of a chalice in section. That portion of the ego which is awakened on the third causal subplane is itself divided into three parts, which we will call A, B and C. A is a very small part of the ego, and remains on its one plane. B is a small part of A, is put down, page 176, but remains unentangled with the matter of the lower planes. It acts as a link between A and C. C, in turn, is a small part of B, and is thoroughly entangled with lower matter of the mental and astral bodies. A, we may think of as the body of a man, B, as his arm stretched out, C, as the hand which grasps, or perhaps rather the tips of the fingers which are dipped in matter. We have here a very delicately balanced arrangement, which may be affected in various ways. The intention is that the hand, C, should grasp firmly and guide the matter with which it is entangled, being fully directed all the time by the body, A, through the arm B. Under favorable circumstances, additional strength, and even additional matter, may be poured from the body, A, through the arm B, into the hand C, so that the control may become more and more perfect. The hand C may grow in size as well as in strength, and the more it does so the better, so long as the communication through the arm, B, is kept open freely, and the body, A, retains control. For the very entanglement of the causal matter, which constitutes the hand, C, awakens it to a keen activity, and an accuracy of response to fine shades of vibration, which it could gain in no other way, and this, when transmitted through the arm B, to the body A, means the development of the ego himself. Unfortunately, the course of events does not always follow the ideal plan of working indicated above.